Thank you. So thank you for the invitation. And I realize I'm now the only thing standing between you and dinner and your reception. So so I will try to be fast. And I also have a cold, so my voice may run out. But I'm here at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I've been here about 4 years. And my lab works on kind of a number of different things, from single molecule measurements of motor proteins and of cytoskeletal filaments through measurements of living cells. And today I'm going to be focusing kind of on what we consider our mesoscale system, which is networks of purified proteins that have been extracted from cells but now no longer have a lot of the complexity of cellular systems. And I think in many ways this is a departure from some of the other talks we've heard, at least this afternoon. So let me give you a little bit of a background. So the thing that I love about biological materials is that they can do really amazing things that we don't know how to do with synthetic materials. And this is a picture of cells. These are endothelial cells that have been plated onto a glass surface. And you can see that they adopt different shapes. Sometimes they're round, sometimes they're flat. They tend to pull on each other. This is a movie that took me maybe 6 hours to collect, and now I'm showing it to you in a very fast loop. But I think that these movies are really informative because they tell you that biological materials and cellular materials can do things that are really kind of astounding. They can move, they can sense their environment, they can undergo transitions from flat to round, different shape transitions. And it's not the sort of thing that you really imagine, I think, when you think about the cells in your body, or even if you've had the opportunity to look through a microscope and look at cells for a short period of time. So just some of the interesting properties are their ability to self-assemble and move. There are clearly out of equilibrium behaviors here. There are athermal noise sources outside of normal temperature agitation that come about due to chemical reactions that are catalyzed primarily by motor proteins, but also by the filaments themselves. They can recognize internal and external cues, chemical cues, mechanical and thermal, in some cases electrical. And they're really constantly exploiting transduction pathways to convert energy from one form to another. And they do it in a very efficient way. So this is what drives a lot of the experimental work in my lab, is trying to understand what are the physical principles that drive these types of systems, both by studying the cells, but then studying different parts of the cells in a more controlled environment. And one of the major parts of cells that give rise to these behaviors is the cytoskeleton, which is the filamentous network that permeates the cell. And this has a number of functions. It provides organization. It also provides strength and structure. It's a scaffold, a polymer scaffold upon which many other proteins bind. It's adaptive in itself. It can respond by growing or shrinking, and it can generate and transmit force. So in this talk, I will think from these complicated cells, start thinking of them in a more controlled way as dense polymer networks, and then I'll even make sort of a simpler reductionist approach to say that these dense polymer networks will be made up of only a few filaments and a few different types of proteins, and then I'd like to understand the structural and mechanical properties of these systems. And the my favorite protein at the moment is tubulin, which is the protein that changes, so ask me next week. But my favorite protein today is tubulin, which is the protein that forms these types of microtubules. So microtubules are one of the cytoskeletal proteins. They're one of the filaments that are formed. They're the largest, so it's about 25 nanometers across. They can grow to different lengths, and they're ultimately limited more or less by cell size, so figure 10 microns or so in cells. They form a hollow tube, so these actually grow head to tail laterally, and then they form a hollow tube. The number of protofilaments, which are these strands along the microtubule, can vary anywhere between 9 and 17. On average, they're about 13 or 14. Their large size gives rise to a very high stiffness. So if you just think about normal cantilever type bending, these filaments are very stiff. Here's a picture of one of these filaments that we've isolated between two pieces of cover glass, right, a very thin chamber, and we can just look at the thermal fluctuations of this filament. You see, it's mainly straight, right? So this would suggest that the persistence length is long with respect to the contour length. So the contour length here is 20 microns, the persistence length is of order a millimeter. And you can actually analyze the distribution of shapes that this filament adopts under thermal excitation, and you can use that to measure stiffness, and that's work that we've done in collaboration with Paul Atzberger's group here at Santa Barbara, and we've published recently, and I won't go into it today. My only point is that microtubules are super stiff polymers. So in comparison to a lot of the other synthetic networks that we have, and even some of the cytoskeletal networks that we have where entropy plays an important role and rubber elasticity plays an important role, for microtubules, that's not the case. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so these filaments, I've skipped over some of the biology. So these filaments in cells tend to grow and shrink dynamically in order to perform cellular functions. And in the lab, that's annoying to us, that growth and shrinkage dynamics. So Taxol is a small molecule that binds along the length of the polymer, but it has the effect of preventing that growth and shrinkage. So over the time course of our experiment, they maintain a constant length. And that's what the Taxol is doing in this experiment. And we have other data that shows that Taxol is in and of itself an interesting molecule, but it's not the purpose of my talk today. And all of the slides that I'll show you will include Taxol in the microtubules. So microtubules, in addition to providing us with some insight into cellular networks, also give us insight into nearly rigid rod networks, right? So from a polymer mechanics perspective, microtubules are a very different type of network. The entropic contributions are really tiny, and the system's more or less athermal. So fiber bending and fiber stretching are really going to dominate the mechanical response. And in particular, we're interested in microscale manipulation. So this is a picture of a microtubule network. This is a magnetic bead, which has been embedded. This is one of these rare instances where autofluorescence tends to help. So just as an experimental detail, these magnetic beads are not dyed. They just tend to glow a little bit because of their inherent structure. And they glow kind of just enough so that we can see them, but they don't swamp the signal of the background polymer. This is the only time that I have ever had a benefit from autofluorescence. Continuum mechanics is obviously useful in this realm, but it has limited utility, and that's because the actual structures of the network at the surface of the bead are really important, and I think microstructure is key to understanding the microstructure is key to understanding the mechanics. And the applications for understanding these types of networks, I think, goes beyond just biological materials, but also goes to nanofiber composites and other types of thickeners and adhesives that use rigid rod networks. So our experimental approach is going to be two-pronged. We're going to look both at structure, and then we're going to look at mechanics. For structural measurements, we'll use confocal microscopy, which you've already heard about, which just allows us to do three-dimensional renderings of network systems. And then for the mechanical manipulation, we'll use magnetic tweezers. So these are small magnetic beads. Their diameter is about 5 microns, and we can apply forces for this talk generally in the range of 1 piconewton up to about 200 piconewtons, although we can apply larger forces if need be. And we will try to correlate what's happening with structure and what's happening with mechanics as a function of polymer composition. So the first challenge was really to be able to form networks reliably and reproducibly in the lab. And this is actually not trivial, because the way the microtubules form is you take the globular polymers cold, and then you heat them up in the presence of the right chemical batch, which includes GTP, because they're catalytically active and include small molecules like Taxol, and they form long networks. But if you form them and then try to flow them into your sample chamber, you get a lot of alignment, and you break the filament, so you really need to form them in situ. So we had to develop a protocol by which we could create isotropic homogeneous networks of entangled filaments, and we could embed magnetic beads within them. The magnetic beads obviously are filled with iron, usually, and much denser than the network, so you have to rotate the sample as it's being formed. But we've developed a protocol that allows us to look at a wide range of concentrations and then form isotropic networks that are more or less the same every time we make them. From this, we can calculate the mesh size, and we see that we have mesh sizes in the range of about 1 micron to about 7 microns. And for the mechanical work that we're doing, we're going to be in this range where the mesh size is smaller than the average particle diameter by at least a factor of 2. And we find this scaling that's a bit unusual. So we find a scaling which goes as 3/4 of the concentration, which was not predicted. You'd expect that it would be half just based on geometric arguments. If you like threw down a bunch of sticks, the average distance between the sticks should be half, should give it the scaling of concentration to the minus half. But we see something different, and we can talk about why maybe. I don't totally understand it. We've also worked in our experimental protocol in order to be able to get microtubules that have roughly the same length distribution, even under different concentrations. And that's difficult to do because as you change the concentration of tubulin, you change the nucleation rates and you change the growth rates. But we were able to find a system of parameters that allowed us to change the polymer concentration by roughly a factor of two and not change the length distribution very much. And it's really important for the mechanics because the mechanics are very sensitive to the filament length, particularly the long filaments. And you see here in these two different cases that even the tails of the distribution are fairly similar between the two cases. So that's the structural characterization. In order to apply forces, we use a magnetic tweezers-based device. And magnetic tweezers are really the first form of microrheology that was used. 100 years ago, people were able to put iron filings on different types of biological systems and then use permanent magnets to move the iron filings around. This is a very old technology. Most of the more recent quantitative versions of this, at least with respect to microrheology, have used electromagnets because you can apply forces, higher forces, and you can also switch the fields very quickly. But there's disadvantages to that. You have some hysteretic fields, there's heating of the sample. In terms of just experimentally, it requires a lot more equipment, fancy power supplies and fancy regulators. So we wanted to go back and see, you know, could we use permanent magnets in this way? And you can. We borrowed technology that had been developed here by Omar Salah's group to study DNA stretching of single DNA. And instead, we used magnetic beads and we embedded them in microtubule networks. And now these are the permanent magnets, and you mount these onto a stage so that the distance of the magnet array from the glass capillary gives you the force. So as I change this distance, I change the force, and I can calibrate that very carefully so I know, as a function of magnet position, exactly what the force is on my bead. Light comes from above and passes through these poles, so I can visualize the magnetic beads. And in this case, we do use partially coherent light so that we do see interference fringes. And then from these interference fringes, we can calculate not only the center of mass position, but we can also calculate the height above the focal plane. So we get three-dimensional tracking of the particle with a resolution that, in this case, is about 5 to 10 nanometers. Although for denser networks, when the thermal fluctuations are very small, the intrinsic resolution of this is about a nanometer. In order to correct for any kind of mechanical vibration of the system, we glue other beads of different sizes onto the surface and we subtract that motion off. So the motion of the beads that we see has nothing to do with the jitter of the experiment. It only has to do with the actual motion of the beads through the network. And we're going to do kind of the simplest rheology measurement. We're just going to apply a step force and measure the response, measure the displacement of the bead to that step force. And the step force is going to be applied by moving the magnet array. And this is not exactly a step because it actually takes some physical time to move the magnet, but it's fairly quick. We use a fast magnet that moves at a fast stage. It moves at 100 millimeters per second. In an elastic case, we'd expect to just see another top hat response where the difference in amplitudes here gives you the spring constant. In a liquid, we would expect to see a constant velocity during the time that the force is on. And those are basic physics, Hooke's law and Stokes' law. What we see in actuality is something in between, which isn't surprising. So these are viscoelastic materials, and we can look at the displacement. We see an initial jump, which is almost instantaneous, that turns over to what we call a creeping flow regime, and then a jump down to another equilibrium position where this final position is usually different than the starting position, and that is at least in part related to the distance that it has creeped. We take the derivative of this curve with this slope subtracted off in order to trigger on these on the on and off, and that's just a technical detail that's not that important. But I show the derivative to show you where the time on and the time off are indicated. Typically, the force pulse is about a minute, 50 to 75 seconds, and this turnover time is about 10 seconds. So a typical force train in the experiment is that we start with small forces, and then we increase the force, and then we decrease it back down. And we did that many times, and we saw that it was, you know, there was effectively no hysteresis. So we would see the same up and down. So in some cases, we only did up. But the typical force range for the entangled networks caps out at about 35 piconewtons, because above that, you actually rip the beads right out of the network. So first, let's look at the elastic phase, right, which is when we first put on the force, the instantaneous jump of the bead. So we can look now at the force divided by that instantaneous jump distance. This is units of a spring constant. A lot of people will interpret these types of microrheology measurements in terms of modulus. And we've chosen not to do that. We've chosen to use spring constant, which is a geometric dependent parameter. And that's a purposeful choice on our part, because I don't necessarily think that the microscale mechanical properties that we're measuring are clearly related to the bulk moduli. I don't know how to do that. So we could divide by another length scale here and report a modulus, but I think this is a much more localized parameter. So as we look at this as a function of force from about 0 to 35 piconewtons, we see that as we increase the polymer concentration, which goes here from black to red to blue, we get a stiffening response. And it's linear, it seems, at low forces, and then there's a stiffening, a stress stiffening at higher forces. A transition's a little bit clearer to see if instead of plotting stiffness as a function of force, I plot stiffness as a function of strain, where I've defined my strain as that initial jump distance divided by the mesh size, and that's the mesh size that I determined through confocal microscopy. Then you see up until about 70% strains, this is flat, and you could argue that the blue curve might have a little bit of an increase here. The reviewers did, but I think this is more or less flat. And then above that, you see a stiffening response. So. We can also look at how this stiffness changes as a function of tubulin concentration. It's linear. That's what you would expect for an enthalpic network or a mechanical network where rubber elasticity is not important. So we see as we increase the amount of filaments that are present, we get an increase in stiffness that's linear with the number of filaments. So that makes sense. Now we wanted to look at this second phase, right, this creeping flow regime. And we wanted to characterize this velocity, how that changes as a function of force. And this is a bit more confusing. So if we look at velocity as a function of force, we see that from 18 micromolar tubulin down to 26, we see a decrease in the velocity. It doesn't decrease further to 51 micromolar. And we don't, I'll come back to this at the end, but at this stage of this story, we didn't really understand what this was coming from. We couldn't really understand what was giving rise to this crossover frequency. We couldn't understand what was giving rise to this type of creeping flow. And just to summarize this, we saw this short time elastic response was linear to fairly high strain, 75%, that stiffness was proportional to polymer concentration, which makes sense, I think, for athermal networks. The turnover to the creeping flow didn't make sense. And that's because at 10 seconds, it's really too slow for fluid motion, right? The mesh size is huge. So the fluid's moving through that mesh really quickly. And it's too fast for reptation. Like reptation of 10 micron or 20 micron filaments must be longer than 10 seconds. So at this point, the origins of this creeping flow were really unclear. And we felt like in order to understand that better, we really needed to visualize the network at the same time that we were applying stress. So to do that, we developed a simple magnetic tweezer, which was side-mounted onto a confocal microscope. The long pendant arm here, there's just two permanent magnets that can come in very close contact with the sample. And this is just a sketch that shows you that the magnet can come within a millimeter or so of the sample plane. And then we can calibrate this so that we know exactly the forces that are being applied during the time that we're visualizing it. This is the typical force displacement curve that we get. So as you move to different positions away from the edge of the cover slip, you can see sort of the edge of the tape, I guess. You can see that the forces decrease. You could actually exploit this by doing lots of simultaneous measurements at different forces if you chose, although that's not what we did here. And it depends not only on the X position, but also on the Y position. So you have a force metric now as a function of radial distance away from the magnets. And depending upon the type of bead that we use, there's different maximum forces that we could apply with our prototype device. So we were able to get about 25 piconewtons with the 4.5 micron beads, which are the ones that I'm showing you. But if we use larger beads, we could get into the nanonewton range. We've since developed other magnetic tweezers devices for microrheology measurements. I don't have time to tell you about them, but in some of those, we've used iron focusing tips to be able to apply, you know, nanonewton forces even to the small beads. We've also developed ways to apply oscillatory forces using permanent magnet-based materials. And if there's questions about that, I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards. But now it's possible for us to simultaneously pull and visualize the networks. So again, here's my autofluorescent bead. It shows up here in my bright field image. This is bright field, this is confocal microscopy. So in bright field, these networks don't have enough contrast for me to actually see them. I can only see them in fluorescence. And this is us just in a very early experiment, crudely moving the magnet back and forth. And we can see that the filaments are stretching as we pull them. There's no indication of filaments that are stuck to the bead. So the bead seems to be fairly well passivated. And as we drive the bead into the network, we can see that it's stretching you know, it's stretching around. And actually here, this is an entrained particle. This is a latex bead, so it's not being influenced directly by the magnetic field. It's only being entrained by the motion of the network. And you can see that it's also moving as we push on the network. So this is just a still shot, so you can really see. There is a sort of slight depletion layer around the bead, and we can talk about why that may or may not occur. But I don't think it's that important. As we drive this into the bead, we can see that there's compression in front of the network, and there's a vacancy behind. So there's no indication of anything behind the network. There was also no obvious flow, right? There was no obvious movement of the network. There was no obvious rearrangement of the network when we did this measurement. We can repeat all of those tests with weak cross-linking. So the theory that started to emerge was, if this isn't due to actual movement of the polymers, maybe it's due to adhesive interactions that are binding and unbinding. So the polymers are actually sort of stuck to each other. And the thing that we're seeing as a creeping flow is actually unbinding of filaments from each other. But because we didn't have any cross-linkers added into that system, it was difficult for us to know what the origins of that would be. Although there have been indications, at least in the actin literature, which is another cytoskeletal polymer, that those adhesive actions can occur and they can be mediated by divalent ions, which we have here. So if we do cross-link the system, we can see a stiffening here. D1 is the elastic jump up, D2 is the elastic jump down, which is always a little smaller. It's more linear, so I get a linear range basically over the entire range of forces that I see. But there's not any like really dramatic difference in stiffness. I get almost exactly the same creeping speed that I saw before in the terms of this sparse cross-linking. So in terms of trying to elucidate what's happening in the creeping regime, this didn't give us as much information as we had hoped. The biggest thing that we saw change was that when we applied forces to the magnetic bead in the cross-link networks, the range of deformation was much larger. So latex beads that were, you know, 5 particle diameters away were still moving quite a bit, and beads that were closer were moving substantially when we applied forces to the magnetic bead. In the entangled network, that wasn't the case, right? So here the yellow is like the original position, and you can see how much they've moved afterwards. And if we then looked with our portable tweezer and we actually looked at the network, here the red is the original position, the green is the position once we've applied force. In the entangled case, you can see most of the red and green, the yellow is an overlap, right? So most of the places where you see red and green separately are right at the surface of the bead, and you get these huge bends that are occurring right at the surface of the bead. Whereas in the cross-link network, you can see red and green that permeate a much further away from the surface of the bead. And in fact, we don't see those bends. We see more of a banded structure which moves over much larger length scales. So just to summarize the entangled and sort of sparsely cross-linked story, we developed this method to be able to apply forces while we looked at the mechanics, we looked at the structures, which I think is really important for these systems. I don't think we would get the right answers necessarily if we weren't actually able to visualize while we applied force. And then we saw linear elasticity and this long-time creeping flow, which was a bit of a mystery in terms of the origins. And then imaging indicated this compression in front of the beads with an accumulation of filaments that might be leading to the onset of that stress stiffening as you start piling up all of those filaments in front of you. And we began to believe that there might be evidence of transient cross-linkers and adhesive interactions. So our current work, we wrote this up and this was recently published in Soft Matter. Our current work is trying to push this idea. So is it possible that the presence of transient cross-linking or adhesive interactions in the system is giving rise to a bond breakage behavior that looks like creeping flow? And in order to do that, we went to much more strongly cross-linked networks where we could really rule out any kind of reptation type mechanisms or any kind of polymer fluctuations mechanisms. So here, again, some confocal pictures. The networks look kind of funky now, right? So before I told you that we went to these great lengths to make them isotropic and homogeneous, we find for the strongly cross-linked networks that's just not possible. And I think it's because we're using, to cross-link the networks now, we're using biotin-striptavidin bonds. We're using them at fairly high concentration. So one striptavidin to every 2 biotins, and then we, depending on the concentration here, we either have 12%, 25%, or 50% of the tubulin dimers are biotinylated. And these are kinetically arrested. They can't form equilibrium structures, and they form very quickly. So we've actually looked a bit at the kinetics of this, and it seems that they form within the first as fast as we can do it, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, as fast as we can look, they're already formed. The beads tend to localize to dense regions of the network. I think this is probably because they get caught up in like a fishnet as the network is starting to go. So they tend to be stuck in the fishnet of the network. So we're going to look at beads that are stuck in dense parts of the network, and we're sort of agnostic to whether or not the dense parts are the same or the dense parts aren't the same. But we see trends that vary as a function of concentration that are bigger than the variations that we see among a single concentration. So I think that that's a fair assumption. So if we look at stiffness now as a function of force, we get a different behavior than we saw before. Before we saw linear behavior and then stress stiffening. Here we see immediate onset of stress stiffening and then a softening behavior after about 60 piconewtons. Remember in the old case, I was only applying 30 piconewtons of force and then the beads were being torn out of the network, right? So these are much stiffer networks overall. This stress stiffening, actually, I don't totally understand. I think what might be happening is that as we apply more and more force to the bead, like more and more springs in front of the bead are being engaged, but to the point whereby the original springs start to yield. So that's kind of the cartoon picture we have of that, but this part has been harder to understand. This part we think we understand better. So once you get to a peak of about 40 piconewtons, and you can see the peak force depends upon the amount of cross-linking that I have. So as I have more cross-linkers, I move that peak force out. Then it starts to soften. And at the same time it's softening, we see a large increase in the creeping velocity. So now the same velocity that I measured before as a function of force shows an increase that's occurring, and it seems to be speeding up right around the same time that we see this drop off. So we're interested in, you know, what's the whole idea behind this measurement is what's happening with the creeping flow, like what's happening with dissipation. So we looked at this in a slightly different way. We plotted this log ln or log V versus force here, and we see that there's at least one linear range. This might be turning over to another linear range here, but the log of the velocity is linear in force, which is what you would expect from a simple Bell model of unbinding forces. So if we had cross-linkers that when they are subjected to force tend to unbind, you would expect to see that unbinding go as the exponential of force. So if we plot the logarithm here, then we get a straight line behavior. And if we extract from this, if we take this slope and we divide by KT and we extract what delta is, we get an angstrom, which is reasonable for what people have found using dynamic spectroscopy for unbinding of stripped avidin biotin layers. So, and the slopes are the same in each of the force conditions. And actually, the fact that we see a single slope here turn over to another slope here is also consistent with what people have seen in some of the dynamic spectroscopy, where you have kind of an inner barrier and an outer barrier that you can reach. So we're excited about this because it seems like we're actually seeing signatures of the unbinding kinetics of individual cross-linkers in the rheology that we're doing. And that the rheology, and especially the time-dependent part of the rheology, like what we originally called the creeping flow part of the rheology, is coming about due to unbinding kinetics of the cross-linkers rather than movements of the filaments themselves. And we can sometimes, if we look at the traces, we can sometimes actually visualize little jumpy patterns within the trace. And in our, we also saw this in the entangled networks, and we tended to exclude this from a lot of our analysis because we said, well, these are interactions with microstructure, and we want to be in the limit of the particles really big compared to the microstructure, so we're not going to include these. But it's clearly an important part of the story, right? So as the bead moves through the network, you sometimes see discrete jumps that we think are due to the unbinding of a particularly important crosslinker that allows the bead to jump forward some significant amount. This is a trace that is particularly jumpy, and you can see here even kind of gets trapped, kinetically trapped for some time, and then eventually goes back to a more equilibrium position. Even on those traces that don't show obvious jumps, we can look for jumps by looking at discontinuities in the derivative or by using some of the step finding algorithms that have been put forward mostly by the motor mechanics community, but also by some of the cytoskeletal filaments groups, including Marilyn Doctorum's group. So we can do this, and we actually find jumps effectively at all sizes and at all timescales. And the more force we apply, the larger the jumps get, and the more force we apply, the more likely we are to see these types of jumps. And that's a story that's still kind of evolving, and I won't tell more of it now. But I think the interesting thing, and the thing that that I think is most important of this is that if I were just to show you this displacement curve and say, what's happening, you would almost certainly say, oh, you have some kind of elastic response, and then it turns over to viscous dissipation. And you would probably use the word dissipation. And you would mean by that that information is being lost, right? Like, as you apply those forces, something's moving, and it's moving in the network in a way that is not going to retain any memory. And I think there's something different happening here. I think that what we're seeing here, at least in the case of the strongly cross-linked networks, and I suspect in the case of even the entangled networks, is that there can be a transfer of energy from the bonds that are broken to the bonds that remain. And if you have some of your original bonds that remain, you don't necessarily dissipate all of your energy. And one thing that we see is that this delta XF is not the same as this creep distance. So we sometimes see what we first called super recovery. And what we first said must be something wrong. There must be something wrong because we're super recovering our displacement, right? Why aren't we losing this information here as the network is creeping and as we see dissipation? And I think it's because you can actually transfer your elastic energy from the bonds that are breaking to the bonds that are not broken if you have a few that haven't yielded. And I think it's important because, you know, oftentimes especially in microreology, we tend to look at these types of curves and say, I know exactly what this means. And I think in a lot of cases we don't. And the combination of imaging plus mechanical manipulation allows us to get a much more controlled idea of what's going on. So that's it. Maybe I'm finishing early. But those are acknowledgments. So the person who did most of the experimental work is Yelly Yang, who's a postdoc in my group, and she was the one who developed the protocols for making beautiful networks and did almost all of the mechanical measurements. Jun Lin was a student in Omar Sala's group and then came after graduating and worked in my lab for a short time. He's now postdoc at Cornell. He did the development of the magnetic tweezers devices, and they worked together on much of this. Bohr is a grad student in my group and helped with a lot of the analysis at the beginning. And then Omar Sala is a professor here in materials who's used magnetic tweezers in different applications and kind of got us interested in this. I talked briefly about the filament fluctuations study, which we've done in collaboration with Paul Atzberger's group. And then more recently, we've started doing simulations work with Alex Levine at UCLA, who's using simulations to test the idea of transient crosslinkers in crosslink networks, and can you use Bell theory to understand dissipation? And in that case, the simulations are really informative because you can actually keep track of where all of the crosslinkers are and what's happening, and that's awesome. So that's it. Thanks to the funders, and thanks to you.
Very interesting. Have you looked at histograms of those jump sizes? You said you see jumps of all sizes, and have you sort of done a statistical analysis of that?
We've done some. So yeah, we have done some, and we are continuing to work on it. There's some experimental limitation to what you can actually perceive from it, but yeah, the general trend is that you see the jumps getting bigger as you apply more force, and you see more jumps as you apply more force. But we've started to do a statistical analysis. If you have some ideas on how we could best do it, I would love to talk to you about it. Yeah, and we've done, I can tell you more after, but we've done a few different types of analyses looking specifically at jumps that we can try to discern, but then also looking at like fluctuations towards the force and fluctuations away from the force and trying to look at the differentials one way or the other. So I'd be thrilled to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, over here. You mentioned the elastic jump back is not quite the same size as the elastic jump forward, you will. Does the size differential correlate in any way to how much you've flown during the creep or how much you failed to recover?
I don't think so. And we saw that mostly in the entangled network case, and we think what's happening is that you could actually see in the pictures, right, there's a void that forms behind. So the network you're coming back to is just different than the network that you go forward to. I don't remember that there were any correlations.
Because the part that you lose in the bell-type kinetics would presumably be the part that's stressed by moving the bead around, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Slightly less recovery.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that are pleasing about the Bell model here, and it's a simple model, and it's nice that it sort of fits up, but there, it's not, we don't get everything out of it. In particular, there are rebinding kinetics that are coming in that would not necessarily fit this idea of recovery, so, yeah.
If I can ask another question.
Sure.
Is there any way you can do dynamical rheology, so do the oscillatory experiment?
Yes.
I think there's there's some predictions actually for transient linkers in how the moduli scale with frequency, and it's different from permanently linked networks.
Yes, so we can do it now. So we couldn't do it at the beginning, but we can do it now. We developed a magnetic tweezers device that uses a ring-based magnet that actually changes field sign. The sign of the field changes along the length. So if you oscillate around that position, you can actually use permanent magnets to provide a small oscillatory force. We also have optical tweezers in the lab that we can use for that type of measurement, but we haven't done that at this
cool.
point.
And do you see the square root omega, I think?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you know.
I have a question, a comment here.
Yeah.
First, a question in terms of how you define your correlation lengths from images, and when you saw the strange three-quarter power, from 2D microscopy, how you'd recover 3D distances.
For the mesh size?
Huh?
For the mesh size?
For the mesh size.
So I thought you might ask. Well, maybe not you. I thought someone might ask. So we look at the distribution of nearest neighbor bright pixels.
It's a slice. So you're doing a slice through the images. So it's not really a correlation like in 3D. You have to do Z-scans to see where the minimal distances are. It's a little bit different.
Yes.
It's like you're doing a slices through and you're looking.
Yes.
Okay. And the comment was.
So this has been pushed by a lot of the collagen world as a good metric to use. We borrowed it from the collagen world, but yeah, I agree.
In the comment was in terms of creep. How do you know it's not bits hopping between cages and forcing thereby through the cages, which is one might expect as you apply the force? So rather than having a microrheological response, you're actually having some force mobility on top of microrheological response.
Yes. No, I think that could
can
be
you
happening.
Can you
I think that could be happening, and I think that's part of why I'm reluctant to use the word modulus to describe the mechanical response here, and that's why I threw out a lot of the data that had little jumping regimes when we were doing the entangled work, because we didn't include it in our analysis because of exactly that argument, to say that those are interactions with microstructure and they're not telling me about the mechanical response. But I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think actually that what we're seeing is like the big jumps that we see are the far end of a distribution that actually is lots of smaller jumps,
sure.
And those jumps are what's giving rise to the we see is a creeping velocity. So
right.
So we could argue about, like, is this rheology?
Well, it's
maybe
it's,
no,
it's, well,
right? Okay. Because not in the conventional sense of the word, right? Where you're talking about polymer mechanics and you're talking about movement of the filaments themselves. This is due to the fact that I have a bead and I'm providing a localized force through the network for sure. But I don't necessarily have a better word to use. Like a microscale mobility maybe is better than microrheology. But I think that it's important because. Increasingly, we try to use microscale devices in complicated media, right? And also because in cellular systems, cargos that are roughly a micron move through dense networks, and it would be nice to understand what's regulating the motion of those cargos at that length scale. But it's not conventional rheology, for sure.
You mentioned the Bell model. So there's a formulation of the Bell model where you can take into account the bond reforming. So if you think that's useful to you, I can point you.
Okay. Thanks.
Over here.
Yes.
Has anyone done the single molecule measurement of the stretching of a microtubule? How stretchable are they really?
So Christoph Schmidt's group has done one where they bind microtubules between two beads and two optical traps, and then they pull. So they interpret that, I think, in terms of a persistence length, but it potentially gives you a different type of modulus, right?
Yeah, that's the separate.
It's a different type of modulus,
right.
and I'm not doing justice to the analysis that they did in that paper because it's extensive in terms of the geometry. But that's the closest one that I think I would know of.
Because I'm familiar with the transverse, which gives you the persistence length, and I have a sense even how much you can wrap a microtubule around.
Yeah.
But I've never actually seen data where it's stretched.
You want the tension modulus or the compression modulus rather than the bending modulus?
Yeah.
I think there is data on that, but I don't.
Because that goes into
much.
Some of the theories as well.
Yes. In the case of the strongly cross-linked networks, yes. In the case of the sparsely cross-linked networks and the entangled networks, you know, I'm not sure. I think we probably have some combination of bending and slipping of the filaments. Even in the case where we don't add cross-linkers, the networks appear to be adhesive, right? So I don't know what that's coming from.
Okay, so
hi, John.
Can you fit your creep curves to a power law creep compliance?
Yeah, you've asked me this before. We can. It's a...
What kind of exponent do you get?
It's like a third. Is it a third? He's looking blank. It's a third, I think.
Okay, because that's what I get for microtubules and cells with microrheology.
Yes, sir. That's cool.
So one thing is this complete recovery.
Yeah.
The super recovery.
It's not always complete, but yeah.
No, but so if you had a spring in a dash pot, yeah. You'd have no recovery, right?
Right. Well, depending on how they're...
Well, I think with the spring in a dash pot, there'd be no recovery.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you have almost complete recovery is saying that there's this... It's a much more conducive to a power law rheology.
I see.
Kind of picture. And cells do show that sort of super recovery under similar experiments.
Okay. We should talk more about it. I mean, I guess we have been getting more into the idea of like lots of springs, some of which break.
Well, the fun thing is, you know, you can think of it as a survival curve, right? You have all these different bonds, and some get a lot of force, and some get a little bit of force.
That's right.
So you have a distribution of Bell lifetimes.
Yeah.
And then that weird curve you're getting, creep curve, is really just a survival curve on those springs, and then that's how you get power law rheology.
I see.
By analyzing your confocal images, you think you can back out a strain field and then look at macroscopic reality?
Yes, I think we can. But I think it requires more images than we currently have because they're all heterogeneous. But we've talked about doing that and having kind of a consensus picture of after we take hundreds of images that say, you know, what's the average deformation angular in an angular space around the bead. I think we can, but we haven't. We don't have enough data at this point.
More questions?
They want to eat.
No questions? Then let's call the speakers of afternoon.